You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.
Welcome to a very special, special episode of Line Noise. My name is Johan Wald, and today I am filling in for its usual host, Ben Cardew, and I have a very special guest presenting a very special book, none other than Ben Cardew.
Hey, it's amazing to be here. How did this happen? Where are we going? I feel like all discombobulated.
I'm amazed that you found time between doing your regular job, doing fabulous content on this radio, being a family man, and somehow managing to find time to write a second book.
Wake up early in the morning. That's the thing. Now I can't stop waking up at like 5:30. That's the problem. But yeah, I used to do a lot of waking up at 5:30 and, you know, get a couple of hours done before the kids wake up.
That's the sweet spot, isn't it? And when the world is just waking up. You are here to present your second book, Space Age Bachelor Pad Music, The Story of Stereolab in 20 songs.
20 songs.
Wow. What an interesting angle, you know, because this isn't just your standard biopic. I'm going to read the fabulous words that Philip Sherburn has dedicated to this book. It's on the sleeve. Nobody could quite tell Stereolab's story better than Ben Cardew, a lifelong fan whose intimate knowledge of their discography is matched only by the brio he brings to the page, opening up whole new ways to hear their Dadaist French disco. Very well said. You've got a whole load of people participating in the book. We'll talk about that in briefly. First question, when did you hear Stereolab for the first time and when did you realize that this was a unique band?
So I wish I could be like, well, it was that moment, lightning hits, eureka, I ran out of the bath. But no, I can't actually remember, sadly. It would have been, I think, like about 1991, 1992, probably like John Peel or The Evening Session or maybe The Chart Show, something like that. But it was, you know, how things kind of like come up. Crossed you when you're young, you know. But I knew I was a fan by 1993 because I bought their second album and I went to go and see them live. So like sometime in between there, I reckon I'm gonna go for 1992 John Peel, although I don't actually know that.
1992. See, that's when most of us at that age, we were getting into Nirvana, which was like a massive explosion and grunge. And then we started discovering, you know, Sonic Youth and sort of alternative bands. But Stereolab's a pretty heady band. It's a very intellectual band, if you think of it. Or would you agree?
In a way, yes, but also they've got those kind of very simple thrills, you know, like particularly in the early days, they had like those distorted guitars and really fast drums. And it was kind of thing that you could dance to down at the indie disco. Like look at French Disco, probably their best known song. In a way, it's like lyrics about like revolution and uprising and that kind of thing. But if you listen, it's just like a really good indie pop song as well, you know, and you could say, yeah, well, there's influences of Noi and Krautrock and that kind of thing. Or at the time, you just be like, wow, this is amazing. You know, like it's got driving guitars and a big melody, you know. And they are intellectual. This is the kind of thing you go back, you know, you go back to and they've got lots of depth and you get all the references and that kind of thing. But like when you're, you can also just enjoy them on a very, very simple level. You know, like being a sort of old man now, like I sort of put Stereolab on and like go running or go out walking and just have like a purely kind of visceral response to them as well.
Yeah. Well, I guess you've kind of answered my next question, which is what was it about this band that you thought they deserved a book to be written about? But can you expand on this? Like, you know, you've written about Daft Punk. That was your first book. Why Stereolab, why did you choose Stereolab as your second subject?
Well, there's got to be like three things. Firstly, you got to love the band. Otherwise, totally pointless. Secondly, you've got to have a lot to say about them. Because there are bands I love, I've got almost nothing to say about. You know, like, I don't know, like The Jam. I really like The Jam, but could I write a book about them? Not really. I mean, I'm sure I could if, like, you know, really put myself down, but I don't particularly.
Or if someone offered you like 50,000.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. It'd take a couple of years and, you know. But like Stereolab, there's so much to say about them. You know, it's like, there's so many different things. Like that's like 90,000 words. I could have written a lot more. I could have gone down lots of other alleyways and that kind of thing. And the other thing I think is like having some kind of personal connection. So I was into them since like 1992. So like you're talking like decades and decades. I saw them live in 93. I've seen them live 5 times in total. I've interviewed them. So like, it's not like, again, Nirvana, to give an example, who I never saw live, never interviewed. You know, I could maybe write a book about them, but like, it wouldn't have that personal connection. And also, no one else had done it. And as I told you yesterday, if you can't be the best, be the first.
I was so amazed when I put, you know, I did a little cheating and I went on Gemini, said, how many official books have been written about Stereolab? The first one to come up was yours. And I was so impressed. And I was like, why is Gemini speaking in past tense about a release date that still hasn't happened? Because when we're recording this, as that you're listening, we're recording it 4 days, right? Before, what's today? Today's the 13th.
A week, yeah.
Before exactly. The official publication of the book, right? And Gemini's like, yes, it was published in, you know, in the future.
I would like to say thank you to our AI overlords at this moment for helping me out with my promotion.
My God, yes. And it's amazing, don't you think, that a band that has such a strong cult following, that has been operating at the highest level of their own excellence for so many decades, hasn't had other books written about them?
No, it's incredible, isn't it? Particularly, there's so much to say about them. But I think there's a couple of things there. Firstly, like, Stereolab's reputation for a few years wasn't as great as it should be. You know, like, towards the end of their life, you've talked about going to see them in Madrid, and there were like
20 people
there, which is a disgrace. But like, you know, they weren't at the heights. People were like, oh, it's another Stereolab album. Oh, Stereolab, they'll come around again. And even I had a bit of that. You know, I love them, but even though I was like, oh, well, nothing, I won't go to that gig. I'm sure I can see them next year or whatever. So their reputation wasn't as high as it should be. And then they split up or took a hiatus, however you want to put it. And it's sort of that sort of gradually drove it back up, you know. And like, by the time they came back in 2019, people were like, whoa, Stereolab, you know. But like, that didn't happen. Their reputation, like, in 2000 and the late 2000s, I don't think people would have been thinking of writing a book about them, maybe, even if they should have been. And the other thing is, I think, again, I might be right, but I think over the past years there's been a real explosion in the number of like music books. Much as like, there's far less music magazines, but the number of music books has gone up, I think, quite a lot. And now there are books, you know, if you look at Jawbone Press, who are the people who've very kindly published this book. If you look at the kind of books they've published, like, there's some pretty brilliantly kind of obscure stuff. I'm just having a look at it now. There's a book about My Bloody Valentine. That's quite obvious. Roddy Bottom, you know, from Idlewild. He's got a book. There's a book, In Search of David Ackles. You know, I'm just kind of picking these. Eric Dolphy, there's a book about Eric Dolphy, you know. So it's kind of quite, there is a market now for these kind of books about acts that aren't the Beatles, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, sort of people who've always had very interesting careers, but they weren't in the top line, the top build, mid build, you know. They've been there, they might be session musicians, but have been instrumental. But we must say that this isn't your standard biography either. It is different. Please explain.
Well, because, okay, one of the reasons I wanted to write this is because I love Stereolab, absolutely love them, but like, they're not an easy band. So even like 5 years ago, when I was starting to think about this, I was like, what's your favorite Stereolab album? I'm like, don't know. Or like, what's your favorite Stereolab song? Not sure. And I didn't quite sort of like understand them. You know, like, understand is a funny word to use, but you know, like, some bands, you're like, okay, I get it. You're like, okay, you did that, then you did that, then you did that. That's your best album, that's your best song. All right, I kind of vaguely understand that. And okay, that's very reductive, but like, that is kind of the way we think about bands. Like, Suede, what's their best album? Dogman Star. You know.
Yeah.
But like, Stereolab didn't have that. So I was like, okay, and that sort of interested me. And I was like, well, what can I do? How can I get into Stereolab? And they just seemed like so big and sprawling. I needed something to like nail it down a bit. Like, the Daft Punk book was essentially about discovery.
Yeah.
Rather than, I mean, obviously I looked at their whole career, but like, discovery was like the anchor, if you like. Mm. And I was like, well, how can I do this with Stereolab? I didn't just want to write, well, this is Stereolab. And I said, like, and then I kind of, not quite sure when, but I came up with the idea of like, let's pick out 20 songs. They're not the best songs. Some of them might be, but like, they're not the greatest hits. They're not the best songs. They are songs that kind of illustrate things about the band. So you can do that. You could be like, what are the 20 most important things about Stereolab and that I want to pick out? Why are they so special? I mean, things like Propulsion and Romance and Repetition and Politics and that kind of thing. Pick those out, 20 things out. Pick 20 songs that go with them. And also try to tell the history a bit. So the idea was having one from every album. And so then you can kind of tell the history, but it's not like a straight history. It's also like, this thing's important. You can jump forwards and jump back. And so the idea is, hopefully, you know, you should be able to read it up pick it up, read a chapter, and that'll be fine. Yeah. Or you can like read it from start to finish as kind of more history, or like pick and choose as you like, really. And kind of when I had that, as soon as I had the 20 songs,
yeah,
and they were the right 20 songs, that took quite a long time.
Ah, how long?
Oh, okay. Started off, listened to everything. No. Started off, I was like, what are the 20 or whatever characteristics that define Stereo Lab? And I thought about that for like a while, and I came up with more than 20, but I was like, okay. Then I listened to every single Stereo Lab song, and I ranked them. So I listened to a song, and I ranked them according to like my criteria. So I listened to one song, and be like, okay, this is repetition, collage, and politics. And I've got a massive document in which I've got all of that. And so then you'd be like, okay, I need a song from early Stereo Lab that talks about propulsion, or not talks about it, so it represents propulsion. And you will go down the list, all right, Super Electric. And then, okay, I need a song from, and then you could sort of get to the end. And like, for example, chapter 17 is about jazz, and you could have talked about loads and loads and loads of different jazz songs, because Stereo Lab are quite big on jazz. But I wanted a song from Chemical Chords, because I hadn't talked about that yet. So it's like, okay, song, Chemical Chords, jazz, let's do Neon Beanbag. Beanbag, excuse me.
Wow.
Yeah, that took like weeks. But then when it was there, it was like, okay, right, now I can do this. Now I can just sort of sit down and write it, basically.
Because you have gone on record through your brilliant newsletter, the Line Noise newsletter, and you've said it in passing conversation that your favorite 20 songs, your favorite Stereo Lab, your 20 favorite Stereo Lab songs today will have nothing to do with tomorrow's 20 favorite Stereo Lab songs of your, you know, like you change your mind it's on a daily basis.
Well, for example, like at one point in the book, basically one thing I like to speak to everyone I interviewed about this, I asked their favorite Stereo Lab song just because it's kind of easy, you know.
Yeah.
And I've put a lot of these together into like little interstitials, they're called, which are like between chapters, where it's like, what's your favorite Stereo Lab song? And that's like some people who are interviewed for the book and some people who only feature kind of there.
Yeah.
And one day I was like, you know what? I'm going to have to do it for myself. Like, I can't just be like, well, everyone else's favorite Stereo Lab song is this, what's mine? And I came up and I was like, well, what is it? And that day, it was Margarine Rock. From Margarine Eclipse.
Brilliant track.
But like, I was like, okay. And I was like, I've hardly mentioned it in the book. I think I'd mentioned it twice or something like that. And I was like, okay, well, that today is my favorite. And I could have written loads and loads and loads about it, but no, I'm just going to write, you know, I'm just going to pick as my favorite now and then write, you know, 500 words or whatever.
And you've mentioned that you've spoken to many other musicians who feature in the book. Obviously, you took good advantage of interviews that you already had scheduled for other motives when they were promoting their own works. Who's in the book? Come on, name drop. This helps sell.
Featuring. Okay. So we've got lots of like former Stereo Lab members. I didn't speak to anyone currently in the band. Basically, I did.
Yes, you did. No, well, not officially. Not officially as in not, they didn't speak to you for this book, but you did interview Letitia Sadier.
Yeah, but that's an interview that was used somewhere else. Like, I'm not sure if I kind of like... That was an interview that was... I then went back to, if you see what I mean. So it wasn't like an interview for this book. That was an interview that you can hear outside of this book. And then I kind of used parts of it. Like, I used other people's interviews with them.
Mm-hmm.
But, all right, some of the people, like... former Stereo Lab members like Morgan Lahout, Simon Johns, Gina Morris, people like that. So former band members. Also kind of people from who were sort of around that time, like Mickey from Lush I spoke to, and Mark Clifford from Seafeel. I spoke to the people who run the label they were initially on.
Oh.
And whose name I've just temporarily forgotten. What label was Stereo Lab on? Too Pure, excuse me.
Too Pure.
I know. And I spoke to people who've probably almost the most impressive for me were like people who kind of produced Stereo Lab records. I love talking to producers like that. For example, who did I speak to? Jim O'Rourke, I spoke to.
Ah.
Yeah, that was fascinating. He's a really, really clever person. and I spoke to, my God, I can't remember anyone's names. Bloke from Tortoise.
Oh, Jeff Parker.
No.
McIntyre.
Yes, yeah, John McIntyre.
John, that's it. I was going to say Joe McIntyre was from the New Kids on the Block, I think. No, John McIntyre from the band Tortoise and many other bands on, was it Touch and Go? Is that his label?
They were on Thrill Jockey, I think.
Thrill Jockey, that's it. God, getting my labels mixed up.
He produced like a few Stereolab records.
Okay.
Yeah, so people like that. Basically, what happened was, right, when I went to the publisher and I was like, oh, how's this Stereolab book? Yeah, yeah. And then that's quite interesting. And I said, so I then went to the band's manager. I was like, you know, did Tim and Letitia want to do an interview for this? Like, no. I was like, oh, okay. And then I reported back to the publisher and they said, and I was like, would you still go for it? Is it still, you know? And they're like, well, tell you what, why don't you think about who you could speak to, you know, because that will it maybe it work, maybe it won't. You've got to think about, like, if you can't speak to the central kind of pair, who can you speak to? And I kind of came up and, like, quite quickly came with a list of, like, 50 people.
Yeah. Wow.
And I sent it to them and they're like, okay, yeah, all right. That works. Obviously, I didn't speak to those 50 people. I spoke to, like, maybe 30 off that list and, like, another 20 people on top of that. But yeah, I got to speak to some kind of fantastic people, and I think they're really relevant people as well. Hopefully,
is there anyone who wasn't a typically directly in the orbit of Stereolab, but you knew they were fans? Didn't you ask Richie Horton?
And that was the Daft Punk book.
Oh, sorry. Because you interview so many people on practically on a weekly basis. You know, I was wondering if there's anyone that you sort of, if you were doing that, like, by the way, do you have any sort of Stereolab thoughts? You know, that kind of thing.
That's interesting. Like, possibly. I'm trying to think if I did that with it. I tried not to sort of take too much advantage. In fact, there were a few people I kind of like asked about that. I remember speaking to Blake. Remember we interviewed him from Yellow Tango?
Yes.
And
Ira.
Yep. And I was like, well, I'm doing the Stereolab book. You know, you tour with them, blah, blah, blah. Would you like to be? And he was like, no.
Was that like a blunt no? Like, he's got history?
No, I think he was just like, I'm not really interested in it, to be honest. You know, like, I don't, like, they toured with them 30 years ago. Oh. And it's all right. Fair enough. I'll tell you one interesting person I spoke to. It just occurred to me. There's a man called Thomas Golubic. I might be pronouncing that badly, who is the music supervisor for Better Call Saul, Breaking Bad,
wow,
Pluribus, and Six Feet Under.
So he's basically Vince Gilligan's BFF or something.
Exactly, exactly. And I don't know if you know, but there is Stereolab appear. Well, a song from Stereolab appears in one episode of Better Call Saul.
Huh.
And so I spoke to him about that. And I love that. It was really nice to speak to him because he's a big fan. He was just like, this is why I used it, you know, because it's Kim who's listening to it. And he's like, look, this is why it was perfect for Kim. This is why Stereolab was perfect. I'm a big fan. But I just thought it would work because it's like, it shows how she's into it. And it shows the difference between her and Jimmy, if you know what I mean. Because, like, Kim is Kim's a Stereolab fan. Kim's so cool. But, like, Jimmy, nah, he's not going to be a Stereolab fan, you know. And he was like, yeah, that shows the difference between them. You've got her listening to this arty kind of music. Jimmy, he wouldn't listen to that.
I can't even imagine what Jimmy would listen to.
Classic rock, maybe?
Yeah, but he seems like one of, you know, well, anyway, let's not go off on a tangent. We'll save that for another episode. What, like, this is your second book, as I've mentioned, yes, after writing about Daft Punk's Discovery. How did writing this one compare to the experience of writing a first book? Like, what steps did you take to ensure that this time you wouldn't be hindered by the usual blind spots that writers face?
I mean, I'm one of those boring people that's got lots of, well, not lots, a few, like, unpublished fiction books in the drawer that they are never going to come out because they're not very good, basically. And so that, you know, you do kind of learn something from them. But I think the main thing I learned was from Daft Punk book was just break it down into bits. Don't think of it as a book. Do not think of it as like, right, I've got to write 90,000 words. Just think of it as like, I've got to write 20 chapters. Today, I'm going to write a bit of a chapter, you know? And that made it so much more manageable because otherwise you'd just be going, it just seems too much. Yeah. But it's like, okay, 90,000 words, 20 chapters, like 4,000 words or whatever, a bit more. I can write 4,000 words. You know, I can do that. That's all right. You know, just write that. And if it's not 4,000 words, that's fine. you know, and it just sort of going like that, basically. And also what I tend to do is I tend to write a framework quickly, really quickly.
Yeah.
And then hang things on it. Because if I don't have like that framework, however rubbish it is, I kind of get worried. Whereas it's like, I'm like, because I start to think, I'm never going to write anything. Like never. But if you've got like something down there, it's like, okay, well, I've written something.
Yeah.
Might not be good, but it's there. And then hopefully I can make it better.
And just to sort of romanticize you writing, you know, your second novel, you've said at the beginning of the program that you would wake up very early before your kids woke up. Was there any sort of, you know, you going off to some cafeteria at some point or to the library or, you know, finding a public space to write in and stuff? Or
no, it was all at home, really. I mean, we're lucky that we have a guest bedroom at home, for example, where I could go. Mm-hmm. But also, like, if you're up at 5:30, I know my family, no one's going to be up till 7:30 at the very earliest. So you are going to have those 2 hours. And if you're concentrating 2 hours, you can get a lot done.
Wow.
Basically.
Yeah, but you always think of the infamous writer's block and stuff like that. But I guess if you're working with a ticking clock, shall we say?
Yeah.
And I guess that must help. So going back to the original members of Stereolab, when you spoke to Tim Gain as far back as in 2008,
yes,
you asked him if they were still committed to the idea of being interesting, rather than a good band. And you go on to write, to be eclectic in music is to be fundamentally inefficient. Please explain what you mean by inefficient. I enjoyed this.
Ah, right. Because bands, I think people have quite limited view of bands. People know what they like, right? And so people like Oasis because they like big tunes and like loud guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nothing against Oasis. I like Oasis. But that, you know, that's kind of quite simple. You'd be like, well, that's what Oasis are. Or people like, I don't know, Foo Fighters, because it's kind of similar kind of thing, you know, big American rock tunes, like loud guitars, bit heavy, that kind of thing, bit kind of punk energy. And that's kind of, efficient is a horrible word, but you sort of know what I mean. Whereas like Stereolab, it's like all over the place.
Yeah.
And if you were like some kind of big A&R, and like you'd be like, look, Stereolab, just do another French disco, for crying out loud. People love French disco.
Yeah.
You know, don't do this space jazz thing. People don't want space jazz. They want French disco, you know. And that's what I mean by inefficient. They're kind of putting loads and loads of effort into something. And in terms of like sales, they might not be getting the biggest kind of response. But like creatively, I think it's utterly brilliant. I mean inefficient in a very, very, in a very good way.
Yeah.
And I think that just applies to lots of things. Like, you know, most DJs, for example, the biggest DJs, you know what you're going to get. You do get like those eclectic DJs who play, you know, whatever kind of thing, but they're not that big. Like the biggest DJs, like I do tech house or I do techno or I do, you know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. That it's something that even, you know, when you hear music managers or ARs and stuff, whenever they give these conferences, it's like you've got to be a commodity.
Yeah.
You've got to be like, you know, why do you take such aspirin from such brand? Because it's the best on the market, or what? That's how they advertise themselves. Fast pain relief, that's what you want. So Jeff Mills, yes, Detroit techno, pure, hard, you know what you're getting. But when you're all over the place, it's just very hard to find your place in the marketplace.
I mean, think about it. Like if you were designing a band, you wouldn't make it like Stereolab. If you tried to get AI to make your band, you wouldn't make it like Stereolab. You'd be like, what kind of prompts would you have to put into AI to get a band like Stereolab?
Yeah.
Okay, French jazz, space rock, disco, crowd, you know, it's like, it just wouldn't come out. And like, they sing in English and French. You know what I mean? How many bands sing in English and French? You know, a combination of the two. Like, how many bands change their sound every album? It's just...
Speaking of your francophilia.
Oh, yeah.
I had to bring this up because it made me stop and think. When you write about the creative partnership, which was also romantic between Sadie and Gain, you say that they are the... What is it? The greatest Anglo-French partnership since the Concorde. How the hell did you fail to mention Gainsbourg and Birkin, Mr. Francophile? Because all I was thinking is like, really? I'm sure there must have been more incredible partnerships between, you know, a British or an English artist or creator or company and a French one.
Okay, just so you know, Serge Gainsbourg appears 4 times in the book, so I have not skimmed. But no, you're right, you're right. I mean, I don't know, I just like the idea of Concord, quite frankly. I think it was because when I was growing up, you know what British people are like, particularly like when we were younger, it was like, ooh, French people, ooh, Johnny Halliday, ooh, not very good at music, ooh, we don't, you know. And I think like British and French people fundamentally love each other, but there's a lot of that, like, it's like Liverpool and Manchester, you know what I mean? It's like cats and dogs, you know, each other. And so like when I was, and I was really Francophile, as I said, like growing up, I love France and French and all that kind of thing. So I like, Concord was like the classic example. Cause like back then, no one in Britain really listened to Serge Gainsbourg, you know, like back in the early 90s. So it's like that Concord kind of, I think like the Channel Tunnel and Concord were like the two big things. Like that's it, Anglo-French collaboration. Yes. You know,
the Euro Channel.
Yeah, I was thinking of saying like the Euro Channel, but I quite like Concord. Let's not forget Concord. New York in 2 hours, was it? I think. Oh, I never went on it. Yeah,
I know. Well, that's the thing. The demise of the Concord, you know, it crashed and burned famously, you know. So it's maybe, I don't know what. We do hope that Stereolab do not have the similar fate as the Concorde in a metaphorical sense of the word.
In any sense of the word.
Also, World War II, you know, French and English helped each other. Dunkirk, all that. Well, no. Dunkirk was the English helping the English get out of France. Just in time. No, what was it? I'm just thinking of the Christopher Nolan movie. Sorry. Okay. Is this book... Do you think it will appeal to music people who are interested in music stories in general, or is it for the music nerds?
I really hope it will appeal in general. I tried not to be too nerdish about it. I want this to be something you could read even if you didn't particularly like Stereolab. I mean, it's probably not going to happen, because who would pick up a book about Stereolab if you didn't particularly like them? But like, I think you should be able to read it. I think. Casual fans should definitely get on board. I tried not to be too nerdy. Like, the other thing I didn't do, and again, this was a decision I made right at the start, was I didn't write about every Peel session, every flexi disc, every live tour, you know, because I actually started off doing that. And you'd get to a page and you'd be like, you'd kind of been writing about something that was quite interesting. And then you'd be like, and then they did a Peel session in which they played 4 songs. And then they went on a tour which took in Leeds, Manchester, and Sheffield. And you'd be like, yeah, it's kind of boring, that bit, isn't it? You know, and so I kind of stripped it away. And so obviously I've left myself open to people going, oh yeah, but why didn't you mention, you know, that live session they did from Mark Goodyear on? But it's like, well, not about that. It's about readability, you know? Yeah. Like, and maybe in the future, I don't know. I was about to say, maybe in the future I'll do another one. Probably not. But like, you know, if someone wants to pay me loads, I can write that one as well. And it's quite nerdy, but it's accessible, I think.
Well, you have created a little format here. You know, the idea of a story of a band through 20 songs, as I say, it helps you chapterize it all. You know, so it's 20 chapters, but with an extra bonus closing. Well, how do you add it? Like, you know, 2 songs which are appendages, like for an intro and an outro. And I can't wait to have plenty of time to dig in and read the rest of this wonderful book. Now that you are inevitably an expert on Stereolab's music, and a lot of people, when they try and approach Stereolab, you know, especially Gen Z, it's like, oh, you know, you go and all of a sudden you've got all this music available to you on all streaming platforms. Where to start? Where would you recommend someone start?
Well, obviously the place to start would be with my 20 songs, but like, actually the funny thing is with Stereolab is like, you could almost start anywhere. So actually, a standard playlist is not the worst thing in the world. You know, just literally go Spotify, Apple Music, whatever, and like
Stereolab. This is Stereolab.
Because they were weird enough, like even their hits were quite weird. You know what I mean? So it's like, you're not going to get this like whitewashed version of Stereolab. You're going to get some pretty weird stuff anyway. And what I would do is start with there and like kind of note which bits you like about them. and then go backwards from there. Like, if you're really into like guitar-y Stereo Lab, okay, well, that's like early Stereo Lab. Go for the early albums. If you don't like more electronic, well, Dots and Loops, Emperor Tomato Ketchup. If you really like the jazzier stuff, maybe go later, you know. And sort of, I would go from there. I mean, for me, the best album, and I did eventually end up answering this for myself, is Emperor Tomato Ketchup. I think that's absolutely fabulous. I think, like, that is probably their pinnacle. So that is, if you want to go to one album. But I tell you another thing, you know, they did those Switched On compilations of like B-sides, basically. There's one great thing about Stereo Lab is like they released loads of records, like limited blue vinyl, only available in Colchester, you know, or whatever. But almost all of their music is available online. They then rounded it up in compilations called Switched On series, which you can stream online for free. And they are actually a really good place to start as well, because they kind of run you through a particular period, like all the kind of weird stuff they're doing, kind of quite a good introduction to do. So the Switched On compilations as well. But yeah, I mean, literally any kind of playlist. I mean, and if there's a song, I mean, I don't want to be very basic, but it's got French Disco. No, I think, you know, that's the greatest hit. It is a brilliant song. Does kind of have everything you want from a Stereo Lab song, basically.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for down with me on your own podcast. And ladies and gentlemen, Space Age Bachelor Pad Music, the story of Stereo Lab in 20 songs, will be available on most bookshops, online bookshops, no?
Yeah, you can buy it direct from the publisher if you want, Jawbone Press, or you can get it from most places. I mean, you know, obviously support your local bookstore, but if your local bookstore doesn't have it, then go to whichever online behemoth you like and, you know, buy it. And I would genuinely love to know what people make of it. I'm quite easy to find on various, you know, social networks, Blue Sky, Instagram, that kind of thing.
You're still on Blue Sky. Is that still a thing?
Yeah, it's a bit boring, but it's all right.
But is it growing in any way? Because it was going to be the substitute for Twitter, and even Elon Musk's incredibly heinous PR hasn't diminished the popularity of X.
I think it has a bit.
Everyone still keeps on chat groups sending me news through X, you know, and stuff, and all these sort of.
I'm not on it. You were a pioneer in getting off Twitter. I'm X.
Years ago. I saw it coming.
But yeah, like, you know, read the book.
Okay, read the book.
And get in touch. Let me know, like, what's your favorite song? What song should I have written more about? What song don't you like? Don't tell me if I'm an idiot.
Leave the hate for people who deserve it.
And leave the hate for X, because I'm never going on there. Exactly. And it seems like quite a hateful place anyway. So there we go.
Yeah. So let it out there. Well, thank you very much. And also, please, if you love the written word when it's dedicated to music, you must follow Ben Cardew's Line Noise newsletter, as well as this podcast if you don't already. Thank you so much, Ben. Congratulations. Can't wait. Can't wait to get fully into it. Bravo.
Thank you.
By the way, mine is Cybele's Reverie. My favorite Stereo Lab song. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Primavera Sound, proudly presented by Cupra.